This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam, and joining me today is Will. And we're going to be launching a new series into the book of Genesis. And today we're going to be talking about creation, but from kind of a design standpoint. Like, there's something called intelligent design. And what intelligent design means is if you look at the way that there's so much order into the world, it just feels commonsensical that there has to be a designer to it. Like, there is so much precision and order to everything in the way that it's created, that the idea that it spontaneously emerged from mere chance seems more absurd than the idea of there being a designer that brought it about.
Yeah, I think we all feel that. I mean, there's a beauty to the earth that when you look at it, you're like, there has to be something more than just a bunch of cells spontaneously coming together and creating this beautiful scene that we see.
Yeah, and I mean, it gets back to, if you've ever had a conversation with somebody who is an atheist, a lot of times the way the conversation goes, you know, like, especially when you're dealing with something like evolution, because they'll say, you know, you start here and you go down to primates or hominids and you work your way back to the single-celled organism. And the question's always like, okay, well, what came before that? And what came before that? And what came before that? And eventually they're like, I don't know, but you're saying there's an eternal God. What came before him? And so there's this, there's a reckoning in everybody's mind that there had to be something here initially, because the idea that everything emerged from nothing is nonsensical. So then the question becomes, okay, if there is stuff here and it emerges, what brought the design? Mm-hmm. Is it all chaotic? Is it all random? Is it a roll of the dice? And so one of the things that we are seeing more and more in science is the precision of the earth is far more amazing than previous generations realized. And it's actually compelling people toward design, or because the odds are so absolutely fantastic, like the odds of things just randomly emerging with the precision that we have is so incredible, and it couldn't have emerged from nothing. That's where the multiverse idea comes from.
Okay.
Where, oh, there's an infinite number of universes, and our universe just happened to win the lottery and got belched into existence from these other things that we can't observe, we can't, you know, study, and it's entirely on faith to say, oh, yeah, nothing can emerge from nothing, so there had to be something that we can't see, study, touch, smell, nothing. But it's out there, and our entire existence and our universe came out of that, you know, out of nowhere. And that's the primary competing view now, because as we'll talk about today, the idea that the universe has always been here is no longer scientifically possible. Everybody's run away from that. So that means that the universe had a beginning, which then begs the question, what caused the beginning and how did that work?
Yeah, I think both arguments take faith in a sense, but I think after today, one takes a lot less because of the evidence presented.
That's right. So if you're studying, I remember going through school, and one of the things that they would tell you is if you're defining the universe, you know, how it exists, what it is, what components add to the dimensions or whatever of what brings about a universe, it was space, time, and matter, right? Things have to have space to dwell in. There has to be stuff or matter to dwell in it. And then there's a progression of time where things are happening and developing, right? So space, time, and matter. And Genesis 1:1 comes along and it defines the entirety of the universe. Mm-hmm. Like right there, you find space, time, and matter in Genesis 1:1, where it says, in the beginning, well, there's the beginning of time, right?
Yeah, time started.
In the beginning, God created the heavens, space.
Okay.
And the earth, which is what we know materially. It's everything that we can touch and see and feel and walk on. And so in that first verse, God gives definition to the universe, space, time, and matter. There it is. And so in the Middle Ages, you had a lot of people that started having debates like, could you prove the existence of God logically?
Okay.
You know, the schools of logic started emerging, the scholastic movement. Well, one of the arguments that was really popular is called the Kalam cosmological argument. You sound really smart.
Nice title, that, right? Yeah. They should shorten that to so people know what it is.
But it basically says, like, you start this way. The universe either had a beginning or it didn't have a beginning.
Okay.
There's only two options.
Yeah.
Then from there, if it had a beginning, was it caused or uncaused?
Okay.
It's only two options. There's no third option there. And if it was it caused by a personal force or an impersonal force? And so we're going to walk down that road and say, okay, does it have a beginning or does it not have a beginning? And just answer those questions with what can be verified in science. And that's kind of where we're walking in today's episode. So you ready for that?
Yeah, let's go.
All right. So there's a guy named Stephen Hawking who just recently died. For a long time, he was considered
the world's smartest man.
He was the guy in the wheelchair that had the artificial voice, scientific guy, studied cosmology. And he said in his lifetime, probably the most remarkable modern discovery, probably the most remarkable discovery of modern cosmology is that the universe had a beginning.
Okay.
And he said, all the evidence seems to indicate that the universe has not existed forever, but that it had a beginning. And so why does he believe that? There's two primary reasons, and that kind of makes sense when you think about it. So they started looking out into the solar system and the universe, and what they found through the Hubble telescope and others is that everything seems to be moving apart from one another.
It's expanding?
It's expanding, okay. Right? So you have this expanding universe. It's where the Big Bang Theory comes from. Yep. It's to answer that. But everything seems to be expanding out from a central point. Well, if you put the video in rewind, what happens?
Everything comes back to a point.
Comes back to a single point, an origin. And what he says is, because he's a math guy, is he says the math doesn't work. Because a lot of people would say, well, maybe it just did this.
Yeah.
And just kept doing it, cycling in and out again and again and blowing up, consolidating. And he says the math doesn't work. That could not possibly happen. In fact, it's accelerating as it goes out. It's not going to contract again. And so this isn't something that just works on a cycle. So it had a beginning moment that was a one-time deal and will not keep cycling. Then the other thing that he pointed to was something called the second law of thermodynamics, which you see all around you all the time. And what the second law of thermodynamics, this is another thing, like Kalam cosmological argument that makes you sound smart when you say it.
We're nitty gritty here today.
Yeah, right.
This is new territory for us.
But what that means is every single thing in existence is losing energy and heat constantly. So like this has form right now. It's pretty new. It's got glass. It's got plastic, a wood table, ceramic mug. But if I left these here for a million years, what would you find?
Ash, nothing.
Dust. I mean, eventually, this thing, even as it's sitting here, is in some sense in a state of decomposition. This body, this hoodie, everything that we're looking at is in a state of constant decomposition, okay? Because it's losing the energy to hold itself up. The chair I'm sitting in, the table that we're, you know, putting our arms on, everything is going to turn to dust. The sun, the greatest source of energy that we have near us, is going to burn out, like it's going to run out of energy. And so then comes, because remember, we're saying, could things have existed forever or did they have a beginning? If everything is in a constant state of losing energy, right? It's losing heat, it's losing structure. If everything had existed forever, eternally, infinite past, then what would you find in our universe?
I would say nothing at this point.
Everything would be dust.
Yeah.
Everything, the sun, all suns would have lost their energy. They couldn't exist forever because eventually they're going to run out of gas. All structure and planets and order and everything is in a constant state of deterioration. So if the world had existed forever, you would find no order. And that's exactly what Stephen Hawking says here. And he says the theory that the universe has existed forever is in serious difficulty with the second law of thermodynamics. The universe would be in a state of complete disorder by now, and everything would be at the same temperature. Now, this is coming from him. He's not a believer. He's not a Christian. But listen to what he says. He says, this kind of beginning to the universe had to be, and listen to how he defines it, had to be imposed on the universe by some external agency.
Question mark?
If only there were some system of belief that
said there's an external agent acting.
Yeah, to bring about the world. Well, we would call that God.
We would.
Stephen Hawking rejects that and says, no, 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 it's not the direct intervention of God. But he coins it, and I'm still not sure that I understand it entirely, but he says that there's a parallel existence that he calls literally imaginary time. I'm not making that. It's his word for it. Imaginary time, which it's is easily mockable, you know, that brought in all of our existence in our universe. And so when you have the smartest guy in the world who's looking at all the evidence and ultimately concludes, like, there has to be an external agent that's bringing about everything we see today because the universe had a beginning, period. And now when you go, you in the ancient world, all the atheists, it was easier to deny the existence of God because they would just say, oh, matter, the universe, the earth, it's existed forever. We don't need a God. It's just always been here. Nothing created it. It just is. But now that you find that there's a beginning, atheism has a really, really high hurdle to say, how did it get here?
Yeah, the burden of proof is different.
The burden of proof is way different because we know things weren't always here. There was a beginning. And so if there was a beginning, then, okay,
we're in the chart, we're
right?
Going down.
So eternal matter's off the table. It has a beginning. So now the question is, was it caused or uncaused? And so the question, probably simpler put, would be, did all things come from nothing?
Okay.
Or did all things come from a creator, a designer, who exists outside of everything but brings everything into motion? Those are your two options that I can think of. Can you think of anything else?
No, that seems to be all.
So then you get into the design conversation, and there's a guy named Fred Hoyle. I love this quote, so I'm going to share it. He was astronomer, very famous scientist. He says, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The number one calculates from the facts seem to be so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. And the reality is, like, every aspect of this, even from the atheistic camp, and we're going to use a lot of their numbers, it's just mind-boggling. Like, when you come to the table and people want to ridicule Christians for believing that there's a God that created everything, these numbers are far more ridiculous by the time we get through them. Like, you have to have incredible faith to believe that there was no God.
Yeah, it's wild as we get into it to be like, okay, just what makes more sense? Don't put all the baggage behind you.
That's right.
Like, let's just look at the numbers and let's see what happens.
So let's start with Dr. Hawking, where he said, just the odds of the Earth's existence when it relates to that expansion rate, where he says there has to have a beginning because we're expanding, so it had to have an origin. So he's looking at the math of how we're expanding, and he's saying it is amazing that the expansion rate is just right for the existence of Earth to come about, right, and to exist. And he says this, quote, if the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller by even one part in 100,000,000,000,000, that's a one with 17 zeros behind
it. That's crazy.
The universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its present size, which is wild. Absolutely wild.
Yeah, 1 second of that number sounds crazy.
Yeah, and that's just one factor out of dozens or hundreds of factors that has to be absolutely spot on to that degree of precision. One over one with 17 zeros. It goes even a slight bit in either direction, the Earth can't exist. Life certainly can't exist.
Crazy.
And so when you think about that number, I was trying to figure out, okay, how would I explain how tiny the odds are of that? I went to Google Maps and their satellite images. Every pixel that makes up Google Maps. So if you pull up Google Maps and you see the whole world, you look at your city, your neighborhood, your house, your backyard, whatever. Every single pixel of the entire world in that program comes out to be 1.5 terapixels. So 1.5 times one with 12 zeros. So this is a huge number.
Yeah, big.
So you would have to, you'd have better odds picking one random pixel correctly on the entire Earth.
It's crazy.
And then being struck by lightning.
Oh.
Then for that one factor to be that precise and spot on.
And that one factor coming from Stephen Hawking, who has no skin in the game for Christianity being true, has no skin in the game for a creator happening. He's just saying, okay, I'm looking at the raw data, and I'm saying that's the number.
Yeah, and I would say maybe he does have a dog in the fight.
On the other side.
On the other side. Yeah, like, makes sense. He's gone to great lengths to argue against Christianity. But he says the remarkable fact is that the values of those numbers seem to have been finally adjusted to make possible the development of life. So who's adjusting? That's like, I want to ask him, okay, who's adjusting? Because even if you imagine other universes, is it like an alien presence there? And then the question becomes, how do they get there if that's the truth? Like, there has to be a first cause.
It's the argument that just keeps on going back and back.
It's this circular crazy thing. There has to be something outside of existence that brings existence in, and that is called God, right? And so you have all of these different things that when you look at, like, just hundreds of variables that have to be absolutely perfect for life to exist on Earth. So let's just go through a couple of them, right? Yeah. So we have the perfect expansion rate of the universe. That's what he's talking about. So boom, if it's even slightly different.
After one second,
nothing comes about. The math doesn't work. The rate and the safety of expansion falls apart. We live in the habitable zone of our galaxy. So if you look at the Milky Way galaxy, what kind of galaxy is it?
Spiral.
It's spiral, and it has these huge bands that come out. And what happens is there's all kinds of dust and meteors and comets and everything else. That's what those bands are made up of. If you live in there, chances are your place is going to get pummeled with different things flying around. But we just so happen to live in one of the safe little non-busy parts of that galaxy. If that's different, our Earth would not exist for so long.
Could you imagine just things flying through space and hitting us all the time? Yeah. We'd be like, what are we doing here?
Mass extinction event every time that happens. Like, it wouldn't be conducive to life.
That'd be scary.
So then you have another one, non-eccentric neighboring orbits. So when you look at our solar system, everything moves in its own lane. You know, you don't have ones that are like doing this stuff to where you're barely missing them every time it's revolving around the sun.
Yeah, we're not crossing our fingers thinking, no.
Yeah, I mean, we have Pluto that kind of does a little bit of a weird thing with its...
Do we count that as a planet anymore?
I do.
It's been up and down since I was a child, so
I'm on team Pluto.
Okay.
I got mad when they took it off and happy dwarf when they star. Added it back in. Yeah. So, but here you have, like, there's the moon. The moon's rotation around us is so perfect with the tides and everything else that are absolutely necessary to sustain life. Because if our oceans and lakes and rivers went stagnant, then Earth would die. Like, we would lose our population. The food chain would get all messed up. So even the way that the moon's distance as it rotates, perfect. The way that it revolves and the way that it rotates around us and the tides and everything else. Perfect. Our star type. You ever think of that?
I've never thought of those words.
Like when we get solar flares, it messes up with the Earth. And those are just minor solar flares on the surface of the sun. But in whole 93 million miles away from us, our sun stays at the same heat. It just continues to generate consistent energy. You go to some other stars that are like volatile, we'd be toast. Mm-hmm. But thankfully,
doesn't pulsate and just crush us.
That's correct. We have this consistent star. The distance of the sun from us, perfect. The size of the sun in relation to us, perfect. The size, distance, orbit of the moon, the fine-tuned force of gravity. If it were a little bit more, life's done. If it's a little bit less, life's done. The density of the Earth's metallic core, the way that there's water and liquid underneath the plates that move around and release heat, the unusual magnetic radiation shield that blocks and burns things up when they do come into our orbit, like the formula for nuclear cohesion, which is too complex for me to even understand or get into, but
Google
I've listened
that.
To somebody who made it sound really important. The perfect composition of our atmosphere for life and breath and the axial tilt that allows for seasons. We don't think about that, but if our Earth was directly 90-degree angle from the sun, perpendicular, it doesn't work. But the fact that it's tilted like this, so that where you get seasons as it's revolving around the sun.
And it's not just it's 23.5 degrees.
Yeah.
So it's not perfect. Just like a solid 50 or they didn't round it. It's like, no, it's exact.
It is so perfect for life and seasons. The water vapor, the greenhouse effect, the speed of which the Earth is rotating.
Which is crazy. We don't think about that. We're rotating constantly.
Oh, we're moving really fast. When you think there's 25,000 miles is the circumference of the Earth, and we do that once a day, every day you're doing 25,000 miles.
It's crazy.
Right? And then you think, okay, 93 times pi r, whatever, 2 pi r, to do the circumference around the sun, we're going how many millions of miles?
We're flying.
And you don't even feel it. You're, and then who only knows how fast we're going around in our galaxy. And yet all of it is perfectly calibrated to where you don't feel that when you're sitting.
No, my
here.
Feet are on the ground.
Yeah. You feel perfectly fine. You don't feel like, oh my gosh, I'm on this rock that's hurtling at hundreds of thousands of miles an hour or whatever it is. So all of that, there was a guy who was a professor at Princeton University. His name's Donald Page. And he's, you know, he's not a believer either, I don't think. But he sat down and he said, okay, if I take conservatively and I look at all of these different things, what would it take for this Earth and all of the ways that it's perfectly designed to sustain life, what would be the odds of it? And he came up with a number that it would be 1 over 1 with 124 zeros after it. Like, your brain, my brain, cannot possibly calculate or even contemplate how small that number is.
Yeah, I'm looking at the number right now and it just makes no sense.
It is statistically, it's zero. It's impossible. It's utterly impossible. And so, you know, just like we did with the Google map, you know, the pixels.
Yeah, let's make this
reasonable. It doesn't work. It doesn't, because the number's way, it doesn't work with Google Maps anymore. So now we have to, let's go outward. And now we're looking at the total number of atoms. Okay, in the known universe.
The building blocks of life, yeah.
Right. So we're not talking about pixels on the Earth. We're talking about atoms. You can't see with the naked eye. There's so many of them all throughout the known galaxy, estimating that it's 15 billion light years to the end of the galaxy, and all the atoms that have to exist in every star, every planet, every moon, meteor, all of it. If you were to total them up, and this is, you know, the estimates are that that would be 10 to the 80th power, or a 1 with 80 zeros would be the total number of atoms. That's still less
than
the odds that they're putting with a 1 over 124, a 1 with 124 zeros.
So like a good amount less.
Yeah.
Like we're not talking like it's a little bit. It's like, that's enough.
A lot less. And so you would have better odds picking one atom. Pick any galaxy of the 100 billion galaxies. Pick one atom in any of them, and your odds of being Earth generating a life-conducive environment,
it's crazy,
is less.
It's insane.
That's wild. So you'd have to pick one atom, and then you would have to do the Google Earth selecting correctly 3 times in a row, 1 pixel out of all of Google Earth after you've correctly selected the one atom in the known universe.
So your chances are high.
So you're telling me there's a chance. Yeah. It's crazy. And yet, like, here's the frustrating thing is you'll have the atheist that comes to believers and will shame them into feeling like, oh, you hold the ridiculous position. And it's like,
wait.
No. Like, the Christian position, the theistic position, is far, far, far more rational than saying, I believe those numbers.
Yeah, this just happened.
Randomly worked out. We're really lucky. And so, but that's not all you need. So there you have, okay, yeah, the Earth is made to where it can sustain life. All those variables just perfectly line up. Okay, great. Well, how
did
you
get life? Yeah.
How do you get life? And that's where various scientists have placed the probability of a living cell emerging randomly, even when you give it all the necessary building blocks for life. So, like, that doesn't answer the question, how do those building blocks
give them a fighting chance? Yeah.
But let's say, okay, you're given them, and the odds are, from the most conservative to the most liberal, 1 over 10 to the 40th power, 1 over 10, or a 1 with 40 zeros, that's still an unthinkable number. all the way to 1 over 1 with 390 zeros. Again, an even more crazy number than Paige gave from Princeton. So the idea that this happens is just so absurd that it defies credulity to say, yes, I believe that. Like, yeah. I'll say this. The burden of proof is on the atheist, mm-hmm. not the belief. We have the credible position. So probably the most famous atheist in the world, who suddenly now is calling himself a cultural Christian and hoping that Christianity wins because the atheistic and woke framework are falling apart in Europe. So he's on record saying, you know, I don't believe this, but I hope they win because their worldview makes the most sense.
I like their values, yeah.
Right. So he's come out and says, okay, yeah. Let's say that life did emerge.
And this is Dr. Richard Dawkins. We didn't say that.
That's correct. Yeah, sorry. So Richard Dawkins comes out and he's like, let's say that life did emerge. That's not enough. Because if you have a living cell that emerges, great. What's necessary? It's going to die.
Yeah.
So what does it have to have? It either has to have an ability to reproduce or to mate or to do whatever. And so you need self-replicating.
Yeah.
What are the chances of that? So, okay, great. Oh, there's a living cell. Wonderful. But it's going to die. So he comes along and he says, oh, yeah, it has to reproduce. And so the property of self-copying, what's the chances of that emerging? Because it has to emerge in the cell. All the properties and mechanisms have to be present in the cell, which is another crazy miracle. And he says, nobody knows how it happened, but somehow, without violating the laws of physics and chemistry, meaning it can't be God, can't be supernatural, a molecule arose that just happened to have the property of self-copying, a replicator. That may seem like a big stroke of luck.
Yeah, it does.
Yes. Freakish or not, this kind of luck does happen. So this sort of lucky event we are looking at could be so wildly improbable that the chances of its happening is somewhere in the universe could be as low as 1 in a billion in any 1 year. That's a 1 over a 1 with 27 zeros. And that's just self-replicating.
What a stroke of luck.
Yeah, so you get the crazy odds of, oh, life just so happens to emerge, and then another, oh, it just so happens to be self-replicating. And so that's just ridiculous. So he says, even just that self-replicating mm-hmm. is 1 in a billion.
Yeah.
So let's put that to math.
Yeah, so what's the equivalency there?
Okay, so all life on Earth depends on you correctly selecting 3 people in a row who have been chosen at random among the 1 billion people living in North and South America. So take every country, that's Canada, that's the United States, that's Mexico, Ecuador, Peru, all of us. In the entirety of North and South America, you have to pick 1 person, get it right, 2 people, get it right, 3rd person, get it right, with only 3 chances to do so.
It's crazy.
So, I mean, and this is after you're selecting atoms from the galaxy. This is after you're doing the pixels and everything else. Like, the odds start getting so absurd that you have to give way to the idea that maybe, just maybe, there's a designer. And it's not just random. So when you add all this together, so the idea that the Earth is created to sustain life, that life emerged, that life is self-replicating, the most conservative numbers that you find are a 1 over a 1 with 191 zeros. And we're leaving a lot of factors still
there's just
3 off the table. And so if you did that, now you have to go out to the universe, select 1 randomly chosen atom correctly, and then go back and do it again, and then win the Powerball on 3 consecutive attempts. Like, these people really believe that they're awfully lucky. and here's the sad part. It's not a small wager.
Yeah.
Like, think about what we're saying. You go pick randomly chosen atom in the universe. Go do it again. Go play Powerball 3 times and expect to hit on all of them. And you're betting your soul on those odds.
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem far, far, far more reasonable that there's a mind that thought up all this precision? That made everything with such exactitude.
Yeah, the numbers just add up to where you're like, okay, what are we doing here?
Yeah. It takes infinitely more faith, it feels like to me, to believe that all this was just chaotic luck than to believe that there's somebody who has designed this universe for us to live in.
And you really don't want there to be a God if you're just hopeful that this all just happened.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to be so jaded that you're looking at those odds and you're like, yeah, I want my money on that one. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it really is. So there's a guy, David Deutsch, and he says, if anyone claims not to be surprised by the special features the universe has, he is hiding his head in the sand. These special features are surprising and unlikely. This is a physicist from the University of Oxford. And he's like, it's amazing to me.
And also underwhelming language, surprising, unlikely. Like, yeah. Okay, that's one way to put it.
And Paul Davies, again, who's a physicist, he's a recipient of the Templeton Prize. He says, this is for me powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though someone has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. And do you know how to pronounce this guy's name, Michio Kaku? Is that his name?
That looks fine.
I see him all over. He's a really smart guy. He's the guy that came up with the idea of string theory. Listen to what he
Where
says.
Where do you see him all over? Like, what are you
he's
reading?
He's on, like, science channels and okay. stuff. Like,
just not all of us are watching those. So.
Yeah, well, nerds.
I've never seen this guy's face. I just want to be on record saying never
really?
Seen him.
All right. Well, maybe I... Nerds have seen
You're him. Learning a lot. Good for you.
So he says this. We are in a world made by rules created by an intelligence. Like, he doesn't say that as a, oh, here's a theory. Like, period. There's rules here, and it's created by an intelligence. The argument is so overwhelming, it has to be. He says, believe me, everything we call chance today won't make sense anymore. To me, it's clear that we exist in a plan which is governed by rules that were created, shaped by a universal intelligence, and not by chance. That seems pretty straightforward to me. Like, yeah. So the more you see, the more we get into the nitty-gritty of how life works and how life is sustained and the complexity of DNA and all of this stuff, the more it's like, this couldn't be random. I mean, it's the old argument. Like, it's like saying a tornado goes through a junkyard and perfectly throws together the 747 that's operational with gas in the tank. Like, if you came across a functional 747 in the desert, you'd be an idiot to say, I wonder what random forces put that together.
How'd this get here?
Yeah, right. Or you know, the argument used to be if you put enough monkeys in a room constantly typing, eventually they'll produce the complete works of Shakespeare. And it's like, no, they won't. You know, like,
hot take.
No. And yet, that is the argument that comes from the other side. And I know so many people... having been a teacher of young people that go off to college, and when they say, yes, I believe there's a God, they're kind of like, you believe that?
How could you ever?
Yeah. I mean, how simple. When it's like, all right, hold on. Let's go with what you're advancing.
Yeah, let's talk numbers.
And let's get down to the nitty gritty with what science actually says about how we exist here. Because the atheistic position is the insane one.
Mm-hmm.
It's the mockable one. It's the ridiculous one. The Christian should stand and say, or the theist at least, should stand and say, absolutely there's a designer. Absolutely somebody, a higher intellect, a higher power, formed this world with such exact precision that we could live here. The numbers are overwhelming in favor of design. All right, so if we're tracking with the cosmological argument, okay, so we've answered the question, is there a beginning or no beginning?
Yep.
There's a beginning. Then comes the question, was it caused, designed, or just random? It's caused. Like, the evidence for design is overwhelming. And so then the last question is it personal or is it impersonal? So is the theistic position correct, where there's a God who's engaged, that's active, who loves, who wants relationship, that's interacting with humanity?
Right.
Or is it the more deistic approach that's like, you know, God got bored, he made a clock, he wound it up, and
locked
then he
away,
bailed.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, we're just unwinding from what he created. And so those are is it personal or impersonal? And I would come to this from just a a logical standpoint to say, if God was entirely impersonal, this creator, this designer, let's say it's not even, you know, of the biblical God, but just on the evidence that we can see, touch, taste, hear, the fact that we have the capability to see, touch, taste, and hear tells me that whatever designed us, whatever created us, whatever brought us about, wants us to see. Why? If he's totally disinterested and provoking our senses, why did he give them to us? Why does he care whether or not we have survival instincts? Why does he care if we feel love? Why does he care that our eyes see things unless he wants to show us something? Why does he care that our ears hear unless he wants us to hear something? Or taste unless he wants to show us how things taste? Or to smell aromas that he's created for us to smell? Like, everything you go through, you have to say, I mean, it was just, that would have to be some random nonsensical decision for the creator to give us things to be provoked if he didn't care about why or how they were provoked. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Like, you wouldn't give somebody all the capacities for relationship unless you cared about relationship. Why give love? Why not make us rocks or robots that move, that are entirely detached from any sort of relationship, just automatons? Like, the fact that he created beings with the capacities to interact and to be provoked and to be in relationship and to speak. Why? That's the next question. Like, would an impersonal God do that?
Yeah, why would an impersonal God make personal people?
Right. That makes no sense. So the idea where the Bible comes and says, no, you're created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. Well, what does that mean? It means you have moral capacities. It means that you have relational capacities, that you have a desire to create and to make things beautiful and to interact and to feel all these things. Like, clearly, the one who created us with those capacities because that creator was familiar with those capacities to start with and also desires them. Does that make sense?
That does make sense, yeah.
So when I go through the Kalam cosmological argument, there is a beginning. We are caused by a personal God. And so when we jump into the story of Genesis, we need to know this is entirely rational and it's the best case for why we exist and how we came to exist that you'll find on the planet. And we need to come to this from a position of confidence.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful because at my age, I feel like I'm 30. So I feel like as decades have gone, I've always feel like, oh, I'm on my heels on this. I'm fighting against the skeptics. I'm like the one who's like at college at FSU being like, oh, does this make sense or what's going on here? And I was, but like, this is straightforward. Mm-hmm. This is helpful because there's a confidence in this that when I open the book of Genesis, I'm like, okay, this is not just a wild myth that God's coming to us. And with my eyes, I can see, okay, this is what he created.
That's right. And it is a beautiful thing. And so as we go through these early chapters of Genesis, what you're going to find is God is communicating something to us that's far beyond just, you know, the how of creation. What you'll find is when he lays out Genesis 1 and 2, he's far more interested in the why of creation.
It's not a scientific textbook.
It's not a scientific textbook. And what God is looking to teach us, as we'll see in the coming chapters, is he is a covenantal God that has made us to be in relationship with him. And that, more than anything else, is what Genesis 1 and 2 and 3 and on are showing us. And so I'm excited to jump into that. We want to thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll watch us next time as we continue in our series on the early chapters of Genesis. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.